This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not reflect those of other podcasts or affiliates of this show or Gunna Geek. Check out other geeky podcasts at GunnaGeek.com. Get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1...
You have been granted clearance level 10. Stand by for SHIELD debriefing. All information to be discussed here is classified and may only be discussed among agents of equal or higher security clearance.
And now it's time for your scheduled debriefing. I'm Agent Stargate Pioneer.
I'm Agent Haley.
And I'm Agent Lauren.
Welcome to Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D. Podcast 40.5. We're going to be talking the Dragon Con 2014, the Science of Avengers and S.H.I.E.L.D. This podcast is recorded Thursday, September 11th, 2014. We're a fan-based podcast on the television show Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and the general Marvel Universe.
Because magnets. Yeah.
Tell you what, contact us. Go to our website, legendsofshield.com. We have a voicemail line, 844-THE-BUS-1. That's 844-843-2871. We also have a Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr page. Just search Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D. You'll find us. Also, we have forums on the Gunna Geek Network. So go to forums.gunnageek.com or search for Gunna Geek on your Tapatalk app. Tell you what, guys, we want to keep this as close to an hour as possible, but Kier hooked us up with the actual panel audio from Dragon Con 2014, The Science of Avengers and S.H.I.E.L.D. So thank you very much, Kier. Kier is Haley's co-host on Gallifrey Public Radio. That is the best Doctor Who podcast on the Gunna Geek Network. It's actually one of the best Doctor Who podcasts around. So in any event, what we're going to do is we're going to play the audio for the panel, but because it's an hour, we're actually going to save our news and our comments on the panel for the next podcast, which should be out in a couple of days. Does that sound good for you, ladies?
Yep.
Sounds great.
All right. So here we go.
You get started? All right, so this is the panel for Science of the Avengers and S.H.I.E.L.D. And let me introduce our panel. We have Dr. Pamela L. Gay. We have Michael Gilkey. He's from the National Center of Regenerative Medicine. We have Christina Sizemore. And Janine K. Spenlove. Okay. Would you all like to just start with some information about one of the things that I was very interested in during S.H.I.E.L.D. is they put alien DNA in Coulson and Scott. How do you think that's going to work out?
All right, so what's pretty amazing of what we can do with technology today is we can put genes into people. We can take genes out of people. So there's new technologies that are always being developed. One of the interesting methods that this first started off with was actually harnessing the power of HIV. So this is a retrovirus that can put its own DNA into your genome. And so we actually learned from that to say, okay, we want to put this in, not yours. So we can actually clean out all of the, you know, viral DNA out and put a payload that we want to put in. And that was actually how we first started doing gene therapy. So the field's been around for a while, and it's only progressing and getting better. So if you were to do, you know, this alien DNA, you're going to have issues of, you have to make sure that it's something that the human genome would recognize. You know, would it encode for specific proteins, for certain things that you want to have happen? So, you know, with Coulson, you know, he had that huge amount of damage. He was going to die. You know, his heart stopped for 40 seconds or however long he keeps saying it keeps changing. And it was able to bring him back. So what could that have been? So let's say it was a reparative thing. So let's say it amped up his stem cells. So in everybody's body right now, you have stem cells. All right, you have stem cells that are all part of your organ systems. You have stem cells in your brain. You have stem cells in your hands, your skin, your bones, your fat. So anybody who's a little overweight, you're just storing stem cells. It's okay. All right, And we can actually harness these. And whenever you have some sort of injury, those are actually released. They go to the location where the damage is, and they start fixing it. So let's say that this alien genome is actually accelerating those cells' ability to repair. So that could explain how this alien DNA actually, you know, was able to fix him, even though he was sort of a lost cause. So that's how I'd explain that one. I got a lot of other fun stories, but I want to keep moving.
So one of the things they don't ever bring up is the fact that we have immune systems. And part of the thing that we've had to deal with genetic engineering is pigs are atomically very similar to humans, as much as we may not wish to think about that. And so you hear about using swine veins in different vessel repair. And there have been attempts to use pig hearts that haven't necessarily worked so well because just like we can't get blood from any old human, we can't steal hearts from any old mammal because of incompatibility issues. Well, they're working on trying to genetically modify pigs so that they have organs that the body doesn't reject as easily, and there's actually a baboon that's been living for a couple of years with a pig heart in its chest as they work to try and solve human organ transplant issues by modifying pigs. At least they breed faster. But these sorts of incompatibility issues don't get addressed, and you're sort of left with the hint that they're just sort of like siphoning the blood off of the alien blah. And I always had this, but immune system, but they're dead, but immune system. So that, you gotta wonder how they're suppressing the immune system. And how, if they are, they're slipping Skye and Coulson immunosuppressants for the rest of their lives.
I have nothing to add. I'm a pilot. Don't look at me. Let's talk about aerodynamics and Tony Stark and I'm fighter
in the group. That's not my area.
We're gonna get you guys. I mean, you're the martial arts expert.
Yeah, you're the martial arts expert. So you want to talk about? You know, they're trying to build the super soldiers. But then you have people like May, you know, the Black Widow. Who do you think would win?
I tell you, I have been asked that question many times over. I've been a martial artist for about 20 years now. I'm second degree black belt in Taekwondo, red black belt in Combat Hapkido. I've been doing this for many years, third generation. And people have asked me many times over, I bet you could kick my butt. Or, you know, the other side of it, I bet I could kick your butt. And every time I get asked that question, it's an automatic, because here's the way that this works. Any fight, I don't care if you are trained as well as Agent May, I don't care if you're trained as well as Black Widow, I don't care if you're a 16-year-old schmo off the street who fights you, like, you know, that'll put him up like you're the Cowardly Lion. It boils down to your emotional state. It boils down to the clothing that you're wearing. It boils down to the environment that you are fighting in. If you're fighting in the middle of the street on a rain-soaked highway, and you are in high heels, and you know, and you just broke up with your boyfriend, and you're ticked as heck, you know, 1 minute you could be having the greatest day of your life, and you could get in a fight with someone, and they could be, you know, beat you to the ground, and that's fine. The next day, you can find out your boyfriend has cheated on you, you're mad as heck. That same person you got in a fight with the day before that plowed you into the ground, you will blow them away. And it boils down to all of these particular factors. It boils down to your emotional state, your environment, and it does have a very big part of the training that you've had. So it's very, very hard to narrow down in any factor who would be the dominant person in any particular fight. But I do have to say that when it comes down to the whole concept of, you know, a super soldier kind of situation, or like in the Avengers where Hulk is chasing down Black Widow, that does kind of uneven playing field, more than slightly. Because, yeah, that would be putting a damper on things. But in the overall spectrum of a normal human fight, there's really no clear-cut way to decide who would ever be the winner in that, because there are way too many factors
I could honestly get in a fight with probably anybody in this room, and I might win today, you might win tomorrow. That's just quite literally the way that it boils down to it. It just depends on all of those variables combined.
Yeah, if I could jump on that a little bit. I'm a United States Marine, and so we do... Y'all are awesome. Thanks. So we do Marine Corps martial arts, and we do a lot of physical things, and it is fascinating to see and interesting to see, some people who you think would be not able to do anything could absolutely, whoop up on you that day. And then other things, too, like, I always joke with the guys, why are you teaching me Marine Corps martial arts? I'm this big around, I know I'm tall, but... and I fly, for goodness sake, so I'm not going to be out there, getting some or whatever. But by the same token, every Marine are riflemen, so they make sure that we can all do these basic things. But the fact of the matter is, if somebody wants to get in a fight with me, I know where my skills are. I can run a marathon, and I can run it pretty quick. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go, and I'm going to run and let whoever chase me till they're completely worn out. Then I'll do the
yes.
bus. So, you got to know your skills. You got to know your skill set. So I feel like Black Widow, as we've seen many times in the movies, she is very good at fighting, but she's also very good at using physics, and throwing her tiny little self around, and it's as simple as that.
Well, that's why one of my favorite scenes with actually Agent May was actually in the episode Trax with the train, when they were actually frozen due to that agent, when she's actually been captured, and the agent stabbed the knife into her arm. And she just smiled and just said, "That's all I needed." My first response was to grin, because I knew exactly what she was talking about. Because it's that kind of situation where you find out the measure of a person. Please don't think that I'm an advocate of torture. And I know this is going to sound really weird, but... I mean, you remember in Firefly when Shepard Book is quoting Sean Yu and pointing out, that whole thing, and you tie him up, hang him over the volcano's edge, and that's the day you finally meet the man, that whole thing. I also don't support dictators and psychotics, but so please forgive me for this, but there is a ring of truth to that point, because in situations like that, you do find how much you can take due to your physicality, your emotional state, the level of training that you have had. And when you have been trained as a soldier or as a martial artist, it's that literal blood, sweat, and tears that you have put into all of that that will push you to those levels of endurance to where you can figure out how much that you can take. And it was that training that pushed her to be able to actually hold back and realize how much that she could take to where she had the wherewithal to keep her state of mind, to keep herself calm, and it was that training that helped her to be able to hold on long enough to wait for that window of opportunity. And the second that she just smiled and said, "That's all I needed," I was just, "Here we go."
You can be the biggest, baddest, strongest guy in the room, and it's not going to do a lick of good for you if you don't have not just physical endurance, but the mental fortitude and the mental strength. I went to SEER school back in 2001, survival evasion, anyway. They put you out in the woods for like a week, and you don't eat, and then they capture you and
Like the SEALs
beat the crap out of you. Yeah. And we went with a bunch of SEALs, and honestly, there were two people who dropped out, who voluntarily dropped out, and they were both SEALs.
Oh.
And I was like, I'm not going to go into what we did there, but it was, yeah. I mean, it really does take a minute. You really do find out what kind of person you are.
Yeah.
I enjoyed watching MMA, and you see Hoist Gracie, and you see him, back before they put all the extra rules, and he would just choke people out. They'd be 250, 300 pounds and nothing. And he's this, 140 pound, guy from Brazil, and just whooping up on him. It's amazing.
Well, and this is what you see with the Incredible Hulk is this is a man whose rage overcomes him, and the Hulk is just brute strength. And while we all have moments of, yay, he's beating the ground with, I think it was Loki. There was still that moment when Thor was trying to get the Hulk not to destroy the carrier, of Thor's emotional state is, okay, I like you, don't make me hurt you, but dude, and Hulk is just like, wah, punch through wall. And so you can even see here where the emotional state comes in, where you have a god battling a, I don't know how the hell gamma rays didn't kill him. Iron Man had an excellent point. Gamma rays will shatter your DNA, but usually not in genetically optimal ways. So yeah.
I had a fun theory why the Hulk is green. So with all this massive amounts of growth that he's going through, he probably has a serious amount of bruising. And so with the bruising, whenever the hemoglobin is actually being degraded, it looks like a green color.
So that's why he's green. He was watching VeggieTales at the time.
I love that. I'd like to say I don't ever want to see the Hulk and have that thought in my head ever again. there's a lot of moments
he
where
broke somebody.
Yeah, which is great.
I think we broke them.
You broke me. I'm like, so that's why when you touch him it hurts and he gets angry. Okay. Moving on to happier things, like why the hell does an Iron Man become mush in the bottom of his iron suit? As a small child, I'm an astrophysicist by trade. As a small child, I had a rocket that had a containment vessel that it recommended you launch crickets in. Crickets have exoskeletons. They're good with this. Their internal bits and pieces are attached to that exoskeleton. So you launch a cricket, they come back still a cricket, and they're a little bit pissed, and they hop away. Now, when you do this to an earthworm that has no vital structures, you get back snot. And I've always questioned, Tony Stark's just a dude. He's kind of arrogant, and he's not that big a guy, and he's in this suit, but it's not like they've anchored his organs to the suit.
And the human body is no less fragile. I mean, from my 20 years in the ring, I've found just how fragile we really are. It takes less than 1 pound of pressure to crack the first layer of skin. It takes less than 5 pounds of pressure to crush your esophageal passage. It takes 8 to 10 pounds of pressure to crush a human collarbone. That's it. That's all that it takes. So, I mean, you're absolutely correct. This guy should be roadkill.
Well, except, now, I am not a jet pilot. I am a C-130 pilot, so those are the...
awesome.
They're the biggest planes the Marine Corps got. If any of you have ever seen Blue Angels, it's Fat Albert is... speaking of which, the Blue Angels just nominated their very first female pilot. She's a Marine. Katie Higgins, one of my Marines. I just saw her off 2 days ago, and she's fantastic. She's going to do great things. Anyway, but I did go through flight school, and I have studied aerodynamics and things like that at length. And one of the reasons I'm not a jet pilot is because I am a very tall, skinny person, and I don't deal with G's very well, the G-forces very well from that. In fact, my very first flight, my instructor did a short break, and that's where they pull about 3 G's, and then they land, and it's this thing they do to wow their students, and they landed. And he goes, so what'd you think? And then at that point, I went, What just happened? So, you know, it was really obvious to me that, okay, I'm not going to do well in high G dynamic aircraft, which is what I view Tony's armor as. I view his armor, because you have to do something. So to me, I just go, okay, that's his aircraft, and that he's got the same protection, and if not more, than what our pilots in, like, the Joint Strike Fighter and F-18s and all that have. And one of the interesting things about G-forces, and if anybody knows more than me, feel free to speak up, but one of the things that I found really fascinating when we were studying aerodynamics is in the higher the more dynamic aircrafts, the ones that go faster and are really going to be yanking and banking, they have the ability to recline their seats even more, because when you're on a flatter plane, the G-forces that hit you aren't as hard, so they're not going to scramble you as much. And most of the time when we see Tony, he's Supermanning it. So he's not getting the G-forces along his entire body. And also,
They've got G-suits. So it's actually kind of perfect that Robert Downey Jr. is tiny. Because the guys, and I'm not kidding, the people who make the best jet pilots are short, little, stocky guys. Because they have the ability. It's why do we black out? Why
astronauts
do we gray out?
Too. Astronauts, too.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a terrible astronaut. I can never do it. You know, they've got the ability, aside from doing the hook maneuver, which is one of the things that we do to try to keep oxygen in your brain. And in case you're wondering what that is, and if you ever see video from inside of a jet aircraft and you hear somebody go, and it really does sound like you're sitting on a toilet pooping, you are bearing down, and that's what they tell you to do. By doing that, it helps keep the oxygen or the blood in your brain, and you don't black out or gray out as much. So aside from the fact that our pilots have G-suits, which squeeze their legs, and help keep the blood up in there. I imagine, and I just kind of pretend to myself that Tony has an undersuit that does that too. So that's how I make it work for me.
And it comes and it flies and it attaches to his body and it got pepper and so
magic.
So this is the one thing that, as someone who launched an earthworm as a small child, causes me great out of the moment experience watching Avengers and Iron Man. So how many of you have noticed that with your seatbelt, if you pull slowly, it comes forward, and if you yank on it, you get a few inches before it stops cold? Well, it used to be that when you yanked quickly, you just got nothing. And what they realized is when a car had a crash, your body would stop over a quarter of a centimeter or something, and your heart would then come disattached as it slammed into the front of your chest. So it's the pilots accelerate and decelerate over long distances, and they're pulling a lot of G's, but they bank up to it. It's that sudden...
Not when they're offloading G's. You can rapidly unload and offload. In fact, I just did an FFPD, a field flight performance board, on a Harrier pilot last week who I unfortunately had to recommend he not fly any longer because he cannot handle the dynamic maneuvers and was vomiting every time.
Okay, so we may be having time scale differences. When I say rapidly, I mean less than a second.
Oh, okay. Okay. Very well. I think it rapidly, hit a second or two.
Yeah. So
there is a very tiny transition period which he could not handle.
So the difference you end up with is people who do parkour, which a lot of the martial arts people can do, the running, jumping down the building, up the wall. When they jump off of a story, they land, crumple their knees, and roll, and they're extending their deceleration time over a couple of seconds. Tony Stark just goes feet first, and his heart would actually go down into his colon.
It's a really good G-suit.
And he wears under his clothes at all times.
It's amazing, and he makes Pepper wear one too. Absolutely. Yeah. This is how we're making it work. It's our new headcanon.
You got to justify it somehow, people. Come on.
Work with the actor keeps his heart in place somehow.
Yeah,
magnets.
I was thinking the other one thing would be, he actually controls a lot of his movements with hands, and those then turn on the repulsors and stuff like that. So, how could that actually happen? So I was thinking if you had a set of neural electrodes across your brain, then he could actually think what he wanted to do. And if he programmed it right, you could actually control that. And somebody's already tweeted by just thinking about it. So you could use that, and then also you always notice he uses certain hand gestures. Has anybody seen the wizard robe? There's a wizard robe that's really funny. So it does different noises and colors by different hand movements, and you train it, and it actually works. So you could almost carry the same thing for his repulsor and shots. And
be kind of fun. Hey,
a question.
You're the medical guy, right?
Yes.
On the subject of Tony Stark, the arc reactor is supposed to be like a magnet that keeps the shrapnel from going into his heart. No. Why is it that when they took it out, he tried to act out symptoms of a heart attack? What is the arc reactor actually doing?
I'm going to go with not much. So, That part's always bugged me. So, in your body, if you have any pieces of shrapnel, I mean, I've been shot with a BB gun, and, you know, it comes in there, and or you have a little tiny sliver of metal that gets stuck, it eventually works its way out, always. They've had pieces of shrapnel in, from soldiers that are coming home from Afghanistan. And, you know, they're extracting stuff, but sometimes they don't get everything out. But your body normally just pushes it out. It's a normal function. You get an encapsulation event, so you know where it is. It's not going anywhere. And, you know, as soon as you get encapsulation, it's going to develop scar tissue. It's not moving. So the whole thing about it trying to go into his heart, I'm like, I don't think so. So, you know, if you had something and you're trying to, you know, prevent it from going somewhere, you know, and you can prevent it from going into his heart and killing him, then why can't you just suck it out? You know, you can punch holes in the heart and be fine. I mean, we routinely we have a stem cell clinical trial where we actually inject stem cells into the heart while it's still beating. And we do it through the femoral catheter, you know, all the way up into the heart, you know, it's beating, and like, no problem.
So Jensen was stupid.
I don't think you need it.
I'm relatively sure we can go down the road to Grady Hospital, and we'd probably be able to talk to all the ER doctors, and most would probably say they don't usually have people coming into the hospital just saying, I think I'm going into cardiac arrest. With a very calm look on their face. They probably usually aren't that calm about it as he was, so yeah.
Okay, I have another question about this. Speaking of the aircraft, there's like X-ray scans that show the metal throughout his ribcage and things like that. We're just talking about how his heart should like drop down to a jelly. Does that have any? Like that might actually attach the organ in a more severe manner.
No. Sharp pointy bits rarely help. Rarely help. Yeah.
Think piano wires. Hey, his heart's in nice slices.
Do we have another question, Ben?
Yeah, staying on the Tony Stark subject. Regarding his flight, a different question about his kind of rocket boots and all that. About
where the hell are the thrusters?
Where is he holding all of his fuel? Yeah, is it possible there are any developments that could come forward, like some incredibly efficient fuel that would let him still keep that sleek profile while still getting so much thrust?
I was always under the assumption that the arc reactor powered the suit.
Yes.
Yeah, and then all the follow-on suits had their own arc reactors.
So
is it ion drive? It's Tony Stark magic. So going down the rabbit hole of making up physics on the fly.
Because that's what Marvel's all about.
So there's an actual engine called an ion drive. They talked about it in Star Trek. NASA built it. It controls one of the missions I work on, the Dawn spacecraft. And the way these work is they use magnetic fields, arc reactor, to take ions and fling them at near the speed of light out the back end of the spacecraft, one or two at a time. And this very slowly accelerates your large spacecraft because it's basically like someone on ice skates standing there firing a BB gun. But more so, because the BBs are atoms. So if you were able to use an arc reactor that will just make pretend is like more powerful than any of the magnets that NASA's developed for its spacecraft, and is able to fire bazillions of ions at the feet of the shoes somehow without ionizing him, then he wouldn't need to carry fuel. Ion drives are the most effective use of fuel that we have, and so you can power little tiny things and get them going very, very fast with magnetic fields. It's the magnetic field creator that takes up the space.
All right, so on that, instead of using ion, and we all know about the Human Torch, how he can heat up to a supernova and, you know, melt the Earth.
Without generating gamma rays.
Right, but could the reactor create a small pulse, maybe a controlled blast, more so, in a series to propulse this one?
If you pulse the magnetic field?
Or
that's what it, so if you go to many of the different Six Flags in America and ride the Iceman ride, it has electromagnetics along the rails that pulse on and off, and that accelerates your cart. And so with a magnetic field, if it's an electromagnetic field, you turn the electricity on and off, and it pulses the magnetic field on and off,
and the arc reactor is an electromagnet, otherwise it would just happily be magnetic all the time and not need to glow. Although there are so many places where it doesn't glow, I've always worried. So if it's an electromagnetic system, yes.
Oh, definitely. So there's some really great programs out of Case Western Reserve with functional electronic stimulation. So the question was about can we control neuroprosthetics? And so what we're actually doing now is we control them one of two ways. You can control them from muscles and, you know, get EMGs, or you can actually measure from brain waves. And what they're able to do is take those and then have people do certain movements or certain things and then record them and then turn that into a machine command. And so what we're actually able to do is have somebody that's paralyzed. Let's say they have a little bit of motor function in their shoulder level. So probably somewhere in your, you know, lower cervical, early thoracic, where your injury would be. And if they can do a shoulder like this, that starts a command. And then they do like this, and then their arm will move out. And then they do this, and it grabs. And then they do like that, and then it brings it to them. And they go like this, and then it brings it to them. And literally, you could program that and have electrodes all down your muscles that are actually controlling your body to do those specific motions. So you can also do that. The practice for doing this was actually with a prosthetic. So I had a friend, and he had like the Terminator arm. And what was really funny is he used a Lego program to control it, the Lego Mindstorm. The serious, like, PhD project, Lego Mindstorm. Oh, yes. And so he was actually able to do that. And so he would do different movements with his muscles and stuff and be able to move it around. And then, you know, so the next generation is trying to do it with, you know, the EKGs, I mean, you know, the neural ones. So it's harder to do in the neural because the signals are deeper in. With muscle, it's right there on the surface, so it's easier to record. Otherwise, you have to put deep implants into your brain. Most people don't like that.
And one quick thing is one of the experiments that they're starting to do is putting sensors that can read the neural signal at the ends of stumps for prosthetics. And they're using the electric signals on the terminated nerves to control the prosthetics. This is still not mainstream, but this is the direction a lot of the military research into prosthetics is going.
My question was that in Iron Man 2, it's a big plot point that the arc reactor is lithium-based, and it's slowly poisoning his blood, and then comes from what? Slowly poisoning his blood, and then he makes up the new element and puts that in, and then he finds with someone who's slowly being poisoned by palladium to even function at the level that he was functioning at during the movie, and would it just go away by changing the fuel source?
All right, so I don't actually know about palladium poisoning, so I'll speak more on mercury poisoning. So mercury poisoning, it doesn't take a lot, and it will kill you. So, and you can't just get it out. You actually have to go through a leaching process. So just switching it out, you're still going to be poisoned. Your body is going to have a long recovery time. There's going to likely be a lot of physical damage, trauma, scar tissue that's going to be built up, and that's what's going to be really hard. So it's not going to be like an on-off switch with any sort of poison. They're actually already starting to look at that. So it's sort of cool. So they, let's see how to do it right.
And like what problems would arise with having it?
So there's a few different ways. They're looking at how can you take, I'll take a couple different ways of going at it. So anytime you move, there's a kinetic movement. And similar to what you do with a Rolex, and you do like this, and I don't have a Rolex, so sorry, you have to pretend. Anybody else to give me one, I'd be happy. So this movement, you can actually generate a charge. And so if you did that in your body and had a battery recording all the movements you did, you could actually be self-powered. There's also, they're looking at how to use cells and have electricity come from them. So one of the interesting, and I'm going to go a little bit sci-fi with you, because it ties into kind of cool shield stuff, maybe. So if you want to create electricity, so there's electric eels, and they can they create 100 volts per foot of eel. And that's a pretty good shock. That'll shock the crap out of you pretty good. And they actually have millions of little batteries inside of them, and they're all connected in sequence. And so that literally they say, all right, fire, and all 1 million hit at the exact same time, and that's what creates this actual electricity. And it actually evolved from normal muscle tissue. So there's a couple of specific genes that are different than our genome that give them the ability to do, you know, electricity and shock stuff, whereas ours was more on the function of, you know, contractions. So if you could take those two and actually do some genetic engineering of some tissue, maybe it doesn't have to be something you're going to use, but you're just going to have an implanted battery, then maybe you could do that too.
But a giant electromagnet powering a pacemaker, what problems would arise if you had that?
So electromagnets require power, so now you have an object requiring power being powered by an object that requires... It's sort of... No.
That doesn't work.
Yeah, so what you need is, if you have a fixed magnet, and you... There's no way to do that without being pornographic. And you run an object back and forth through that fixed circular magnet, then that movement through the magnet of the magnetized object will generate electricity. So this is where what you do is you spin the magnet, and that generates electricity. This is how hydroelectric works, is we spin magnets. And it generates additional electricity. So if you do the kinetic motion, your body, which eats food, is the power source that moves the magnet that generates through its motion the electrical field. And the flowing electricity.
Spike back there has a question.
Back of the Hulk. So the Hulk's mass is considerably greater than matter's
mass. Yeah.
Where?
You got a great answer for this one. The never, never.
Oh yeah, Justin.
So the question is, where does the mass from the Hulk come from whenever he goes from Bruce Banner, a normal man, to a 2,000-pound green behemoth? So I said the never, never because it's funny.
So do we actually know that the mass of the two of them is different, and Bruce Banner isn't just very dense?
Okay, we have a question over here. First one is a comment towards the various ways of generating electricity through your body. Like glucose is awesome, and they've made contact lenses that power electronics, and they've also made subcutaneous tattoos, both powered off.
Yeah,
blood glucose, which are pretty awesome. The question I had was the it showed up, I think, in James Bond as well. The mirror/you-don't-see-us technology on the helicarrier.
Ooh.
How close is that to actually happening? Because I know that people are working on it.
We can do it in the infrared.
Okay.
So there is the ability to make Harry Potter's cloak to hide yourself if you're capable of seeing in the non-visible colors of light that line to the long infrared. This might work for some snakes that use infrared to hunt at night, because mice are nice little warm objects emitting infrared light. The way that it works is it actually is able to bend the light around, essentially creating a mirage, and you're hiding inside the mirage. The way that they do it for the carrier in the Avengers implies, however, that because they can turn it on and off, that it is more likely a system where they're using rapid response pixelation with cameras on the top causing some sort of change of pigments on the bottom to mask the craft.
And that is an actual technology. So they actually use that for cloaking, and yes, it's a bunch of cameras. They've done it to different vehicles, and it basically takes a point of view and says, you should see that tree over there, so it has cameras looking past you, and then paints via screen what you would see if that wasn't there.
The trick is you can't use standard solid state LCDs or anything. You need to use a technology where you have essentially a curved
dimple coming out, and different aspects of the dimple project different colors. So as your perspective changes, what you see changes.
Okay, there's a lady way in the back, I think. Yes.
So going back to prosthetics and Winter Soldier's arms, one that struck me in the movie is that when he was trying to hold things, instead of it trying to lock like his joints, there was all the little stuff moving on his, like the rigid parts of the thing. That was for a show, or is there any reason why they have that?
So the way that my chainmail making office mate inspired me to think about this, because he's been making scale mail, is if you ever play with scale mail, if you put it on your arm and you flex your arm, you see the scales move underneath. Winter Soldier has to have servos, has to have mechanics that are mimicking muscle. And you have to have a lot of essentially rubber band typed devices in there that would necessarily be flexing as you move. So in my justification of the arm, I went to the scale mail moving over muscles argument, and that it's the plates moving to make room for the mechanical system that lies beneath.
Do you think it's similar to the Destroyer? From Thor, yeah. That would be very similar.
Destroyer from what? I'm sorry.
Thor.
Sorry, I missed the connection. Yes, it would be very similar.
Whenever we see the helmet cam on Tony Stark, it always looks like his eye is picking out menu options and choices and all that. How realistic is that to maybe like, you know, pilots and Stephen Hawking targeting?
Stephen Hawking. Yeah.
Like, is that target or something like that? Would they have a heads up somewhere?
Okay, so we have a heads up display in my aircraft. Which we actually all call ourselves HUD cripples at this point, because on our check rides, our annual check rides, they make us fly, at least do one approach without them to show that, like, if it breaks, we can still land the plane and it sucks. It does. It really sucks because it's beautiful. In fact, if I had my way, every car, everything would have a HUD. They're wonderful. Ours is based on 90s technology. My aircraft were built in the early 2000s. They're fantastic. I can decide what's on there, but it doesn't track my eye movement or anything like that. That said, again, it's older technology. I have a friend of mine who's got ALS, and it's absolutely awful, obviously, but before she completely lost all of her motion and her, there was a, maybe y'all can speak more to this, I know that there are programs out there that track her eye movement. As far as, so she's able to, you know, communicate online and things like that. So.
Yeah, they use it a lot in marketing, and they actually will do eye tracking, and they'll put up ads, and they'll show where people are looking. So, yeah, if you can record it and then have something saying this is what the view looks like, then you could match the two together, definitely.
We also use it in psychology research.
So, back to the HUD itself. This is one of those, we have this great saying in aviation called the I Believe button. Because there are certain things, like, you want to talk about the aerodynamics of helicopters, and you kind of just need to press the I Believe button in some ways. And so I look at Tony's HUD, and I kind of have to press the I Believe button, because the way that they're fixed place HUDs right now. Now, I do know some jet guys where they have got to a point where they're building the HUDs into their helmet, which is great, because if they're flying in a low-level dynamic environment, and they're looking down and around, that information's traveling with them. But we're not, and I believe with the Joint Strike Fighter, that's one of the things that they're trying to do.
Google Glass does that.
Yeah. So yeah, we're not absolutely there yet, but it is a realistic technology, if that's what you're asking. It doesn't really zero in on what the pilots are looking at specifically, but it does move along with them with where they're looking, and they can decide from external references what they want on. So if it's too, because honestly, the first time I flew with the HUD, it was incredibly overwhelming and I wanted to vomit. It was such an onslaught of information. And so, like, it immediately hit the declutter button. It's actually called the declutter button, and it gets rid of everything but, like, your airspeed and your, basically the things that will kill you if you don't pay attention to them. But they slowly make you feed the stuff back in until you get to a point where you are a HUD cripple.
have one over there? Yeah. Going back to Bucky's arm, the Winter Soldier's arm, in his interactions, it seems like it's stronger than a human arm would be. And I'm just wondering if it's physically possible for that to happen.
Oh, God, yeah.
That strength without ripping out his shoulder.
Yeah, prosthetics work that way. One of the biggest problems that we have with prosthetics is how to make prosthetics that don't shatter eggs. And it's limiting the strength. And if you think about it, you can build using plastics, and they're now doing 3D printed prosthetics for children, because children outgrow prosthetics so fast that often they can't have them. This is getting solved with 3D printers. And the plastic limbs weigh less than the biological limbs. So his is all metal coated, but we don't know what is inside of it in terms of fiber optics, in terms of plastics, in terms of lightweight mechanics, where that arm might be stronger in terms of the amount of force that it can sustain without breaking while being lighter weight at the same time.
And I'm really curious to see how those kind of things are going to actually affect my profession later on down the line, because there really aren't a lot of guidelines, you know, in professional fighting for those kinds of things at the moment, because that really isn't something that's progressed to that particular level at this time. But when they do...
And it's happened in long-distance runs.
Exactly. It has already.
Big in the running community. Exactly.
I mean,
I'm not personally big in the running community. I'm a part of it.
Exactly. It has already in so many different fields, so eventually professional fighting is going to catch up to that. And it's frightening to see how that will catch up, because they will have to find a way to do exactly that and find a way to actually be able to dial that back, because, you know, professional running is one thing, but full contact fighting is something else entirely. You know, regular human limbs can do enough damage. A prosthetic, one shot. I mean, it's no different than a sniper. At that point, you are a walking sniper without a gun. It's one shot, one kill.
But you can get the jam lid off of anything.
I will kill you in the ring, but I can open your pickle jar.
Okay, I wanted to ask our pilot who's here, the helicarrier. Is that one of those press the I believe buttons?
Yes. I love it. I mean, I'll be honest. So I have written my own fantasy trilogy. Before I could write the third book in the trilogy, I love fanfic. I love reading it. I love writing it. And after Avengers, I was like, oh my gosh, I got to write a story about a Marine pilot who gets to fly off the helicarrier. And I totally did it. It's one of those push the I believe buttons unless they know something I don't. But I don't care because I love it. It's awesome. If you go, it's on Wattpad. So if you look up Janine Spendlove on Wattpad, it's there. So it's my first novel. You can read both of them.
What is it? What about some of the gadgets and weapons, like the Night-Eye gun and some of the orbs from Shield?
Well, night gun's pretty easy. I mean, chloroform works wonderful. You just make a little, you know, paintball and just fill a chloroform. Done. You're out.
A lot of that crap exists. We just don't get to know about it most of the time.
See, chloroform on a rag is easier, and war would be happier, because without having the gun, just having the chloroform rag, you will have already lost the ounce. It's a lot easier. Thank you.
Okay, way back.
In Captain America, what about terminal velocity and the viscosity of water?
Oh, I know. I was pissed. I just, you know what? Whatever. I believe. You know, one of the things, I actually just went through, so I just spent the last 3 years on Capitol Hill being the Marine Corps liaison in Congress, so I wasn't flying. So I've just spent the last 2 weeks doing all the requals and everything I need to do to be able to be allowed back on the flight deck. And one of them is water survival, and it's absolutely awful. They put you in a dunker, blindfold you, put you in the water, flip you upside down, you gotta unbuckle yourself, find your way out, get out, and not die. And one of the things that we do is our parachute training, and one of the things that they absolutely teach you is you do not release that parachute until your feet hit the water. And one of the reasons you want to get out of it so quickly is because obviously you don't want to be dragged under by the parachute. But, and this is one of the stories we learned in flight school, one of the flight instructors, and it's a whole lead up and I won't bore you guys with that, but he departed the aircraft. And he started coming down and he radioed in and told them what was going on and he did every, you know, and he deployed the parachute. He did everything he was supposed to do. Meanwhile, he's trucking on down. And this is in Pensacola over the Gulf. And he didn't want to get dragged under by his parachute, and so he waited until he judged he was about to hit the water, and he released from the parachute. He was 200 feet over the water. He died. Meanwhile, his student, who was still in the aircraft, was like, I don't know how to land an airplane. You know, so called back to base, told him what happened. They said, go take the plane over the Gulf, establish a nice little pattern, and jump out. Don't, you know, and so he did it. He waited till his feet hit the water, got out, and he got rescued. He lived, and he finished flight school. So, yes, he should have. Maybe he's a super soldier, and so he can pancake into the water like it's a brick wall, and it's fine.
Hey, there's an idea way back behind me.
I was in the Air Force, and so, of course, I love the Falcon, because hell yeah, PJs. But as far as the flight pack goes, I worked with jets. I kind of know how not useful that is, but do you have any theories on how that might work?
To push the I believe button until it breaks?
I mean, you got to realize that we all know this is all fantasy. Yeah. And some of these things are just so ridiculous where you're just like, okay, I don't care. It's just a really awesome guy flying around. Yay, flying! Yay, flying! You know, that's, yeah.
Okay, so cognitive recalibration, as it happens between Black Widow and Hawkeye and the Avengers, is it actually a thing?
I feel like it's not a thing.
Did his head really march?
I wonder why he didn't go on.
So,
can you knock some sense into somebody?
Yes. So the problem isn't so much the cognitive recalibration as how did that dude get in his brain to begin with?
Magic.
Yeah. So if you require magic to get in, using science to get back out seems to be a strange methodology.
I thought we established in the second floor that their version of magic was just what we call science.
Yeah. Or yeah.
It's like super science. Science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So brains are giant electromagnetic systems, and we know from psychology research that people who suffer from certain mental disorders, you can actually reset the amount of strife and high firing incidents in their brain through electroshock therapy, which can also be abused and has had a long history of abuse as well. So the question is, was this a case of the magic reset the brain in a way that allowed that existing neural network, that existing electrical system to be hacked? And what she essentially did was reboot the system to the BioWare so that the hack was gone. And if you can use that electromagnetic yada yada yada, electroshock therapy works, bridge the gap, and hit I believe a few times.
And she's lucky she had the training to hit him just hard enough. goes back to that too.
Yeah. I really hope everybody leaves here with this new I believe button phrase.
I agree. We should for next year's panel. We should do exactly that. We should actually just make little I believe buttons and just pass them out as you go out.
But then they'll all think we're X-Files fans.
That's fine. I bet too.
I do have that
post. Or we believe in Santa Claus.
Hey, there you go.
Whatever. All right, we're at about the 10-minute mark. So if anybody has any questions, and I do want to let you all know that if you're available on Sunday, 4, and then at 5:30 we have an Agents of Whedon panel, and then Welcome to Level 7, so all you S.H.I.E.L.D. Fans, this is the place, Sunday, 4, and then at 5:30. And then we got about 10 minutes left with these amazing people. Any other questions? Yep, in the back, way back.
Yeah.
So the issue of transparent aluminum, Reardon metal from Atlas Shrugged, there are all of these different examples throughout fiction, movies, literature of super metals. Now, there are also metallurgical engineers out there who have pretty much tried combining everything that can be combined in all the ways they can be combined, in all the ratios they've been able to combine them. And what we haven't been able to find is a metal that is super. What we have found is you can do really awesome stuff with carbon. And so the idea of a super metal, I think what we need to actually think about is the reality is more likely to be a super ceramic. That as we figure out how to manipulate bond angles and how things are built, when we start actually building real space elevators on nanotubes of carbon, this is real technology people are working on, that it's the manufacturing process that's the holdup, not the science that's the holdup. So look towards ceramics rather than metals.
Okay, my question is it possible to actually create like a super soldier serum that could like turn some short scrawny into like a 6 foot tall?
So I have some theories on that. So there's a specific gene that it's myostatin, and whenever it's a normal thing, it's in your body, and it basically when it's there, it's telling your body, okay, that's enough muscle. All right. So if you block it, you get more muscles. All right. So we actually have a mouse. It's a mouse, and if you Google it in Mighty Mouse in a video, you can watch this mouse like outrun any other mouse. He's like kick out, ah, he goes. Right? And it's true. They're also using it for livestock and other stuff to actually grow more meat in a more efficient way. So if you were to basically overexpress that and then create a situation of human growth hormone so that you're actually almost turning over into a puberty setting, because in puberty, I mean, you got explosive growth, lots of bone growth, you have muscle growth, so you would have to do that. You would need more time. Now, the Vita Rays, all right, so my theory of that is their serum had multiple vesicles in it that needed to be put around the entire body, you know, homogeneously, so everybody gets a little bit. And then they blasted them with these Vita Rays to actually go through and degrade that vesicle that then releases the drug. And so that's how you'd actually treat him, and that's how you'd have a super serum. So a similar idea with the centipede thing would also work with Deathlok.
Okay,
he
was next.
On the Captain America note, how close are we to technology where somebody could be frozen alive nearly instantaneously and then be thawed out at some later point and be okay?
Freezing we're struggling with, but there's currently an experiment in Pennsylvania going on where they asked all of the inhabitants of a small town to issue their names if they were unwilling to be part of this experiment. And what it is if you go to the hospital in critical condition, and they restricted this to gunshot wounds, which worries me about the small town in Pennsylvania. One of the main reasons that people die is the harm that has been done to their body can't be surgically repaired before they bleed out, before they suffer all of the chemical processes that go along with trauma. So what they're doing is they're draining the blood out of these humans, replacing it with this highly oxygenated chemical that I don't remember, and doing all of the surgeries that are necessary while you're chilled down and your body's filled with this artificial fluid. And then when they're done with all of the surgeries to save your life, they reanimate you. And this is an experiment in process.
So the biggest problem about cryo storage is, you know, we're 70% water, right? And when water, you know, freezes, it expands, and then all your cells lyse. So whenever we're trying to store stem cells, we actually put in DMSO as basically a detergent and pokes little holes in it. That way, whenever it expands, it doesn't destroy the cell. So there's already holes to let it sort of leak out. And we do it in a controlled fashion, and it's, you know, slower, 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 and you're getting, you know, colder and colder and colder. So it's a controlled rate process. Now, we can do it in cells, and we can do it with umbilical cord blood, and we've actually housed it for 20 years, and then taken it out, thawed it, and all the cells are 90% viable. So it's a way we can do it with cells. Now, when you're getting to a whole living organism, there's a lot of different moving parts here, guys. There are insects that can actually be frozen and then thawed, and they actually have specific genes in them that are different than us. So if we could somehow genetically engineer us with that, maybe.
It's the same reason you can't, like, one of the survival skills you're taught is, you know, if you ever freeze a limb and you go to defrost it, they're very clear, don't defrost it if there's going to be any chance of it refreezing again, because you cannot take your body through that again because of what the water does. It will completely destroy any cells you have there.
I don't really understand how gene therapy works, because I know you can splice the DNA and put a new gene in, but how do you do that by changing all the genes in a person if they have millions of cells? Mm-hmm.
So let's take a couple easy examples. So we're going to do sickle cell anemia. So sickle cell anemia is a problem with the blood, right? And you have a type of stem cell. It's called a hemipoietic stem cell. It's a blood-forming stem cell. And it is a one gene error. It's a mutation. And if you take that gene out and put the right gene back in, then you can correct the disease. And the way we do that, there's the newest system on the block, you know, as I mentioned a little bit about the retroviruses, the newest one is called CRISPR-Cas. And it's basically taking the immune system, and it's a learned immune system. And what it does is, and it's in everybody's body, and it says, all right, here's a virus, here's a bacteria, remember this. And it literally puts it into your genome, all right? So you remember it, and then you can actually teach your T cells to then kill it. So that's part of your immune system. And so we've hijacked that system, and now we're able to use it to find a specific gene, cut it out, and then splice it right back in and put in the fixed gene. So what you would do in this situation would be you would then start killing off slowly the hemipoietic stem cells through radiation or chemotherapy, whatever you want, and then you would have to then put in the new stem cells that are then fixed. And once you get 70%, you've cured the disease. So you could take that with a lot of different diseases, where there's a specific gene that you need to cut out and put back in. And it's technologies that are literally being developed right now.
Do we have time for one more question?
Yes.
How feasible is the prosthetic eyeball that's put in SHIELD, or Agents of SHIELD, when it gives the instructions and it has the explosive that's deadlocked?
Was that a contact lens or an eye?
It was a first.
That was a flip blown eye.
Okay, I'm iPhobic, so I'm sure I wasn't watching closely. We can do contact lenses that do stuff like that and then feed directly into the optical nerve. I don't know about iPhobe.
Yeah, there is visual prosthetics now, and they're enabling blind people that have never been able to see and to see a grid pattern. So what they do is, in a cochlear implant where you're doing audio, they're shocking the nerve in specific ways to make it sound like sound. So now they're doing the same thing with the visual, but visual is way more intense of trying to get all the right circuitry. But what they're able to do now is take a visual pattern. They'll have a camera on the side of your head, so you have to sort of make believe that's your eyeball, all right? And then it's going to look at the scene, and then it's going to tell you in a grid pattern, there's something here, there's something here, there's something moving here. And then all the blind person sees is a red box. But that's enough for they can say, there's something over there. And so that's the first step. So it's not very good now, but it's getting better. But it's a part of learning where and how to shock that optic nerve that then can be interpreted by the brain to a visual field. So it'll take a while. We're actually, with stem cells, we can actually regrow parts of the retina. And people with macular degeneration, we can actually regrow that tissue and return sight to them. And that's a clinical trial that's going on right now.
All right, give it up for our brilliant panel.
So this is Stargate Pioneer back with you. We just wanted to say thank you very much for listening. We will be talking about this panel in the next podcast. That will be Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast number 41. So go ahead, check that out. Hear Haley, Lauren, and myself talk about it and talk about all the news for the week as well. If you're getting this tomorrow when it's released, we will have the next podcast out in a couple of days. So don't fret. I haven't forgotten about it. So hope you've enjoyed it. Ladies, do you have anything else?
Science. Yeah.
So go ahead, go to the next podcast. We will be talking all about this. And thank you very much, Kier, again, for providing the audio for this. So until next week, I'm Agent Stargate Pioneer.
I'm Agent Haley.
And I'm Agent Lauren.
We will see you in a couple days. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Later.
Thank you for listening. If you want to leave us feedback, go to gunnageek.com and you'll find all of our contact information in other shows. You can also visit legendsofshield.com where you'll find our complete archive of podcasts. The music heard on this podcast is by Kevin McLeod and can be found at incompetech.com. The opinions heard on this podcast are those of the individual host and do not represent Legends, Stream, or Gunna Geek. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is the property of the Disney Corporation. No infringement is intended.